London, 2017. A chair covered with sunken-in speakers rotates, revealing supermodel Kate Moss perched on its black leather seat.
On Christmas Day, 2016, we heard with shock and disbelief that our dear friend George Michael had passed away. Only days before, he was putting the finishing touches to the film you're about to see. This is George's film, Freedom, and it's his final work.
The chair turns again, then fire rises in darkness, first as sparks, then as a line of crackling flames.
Looking for some education, make my way into the night. All that bullshit conversation, baby, can't you read the signs?
A George Michael film.
I don't even want to waste your time. Let's just say that maybe you could help me ease my mind.
Directed by George Michael and David Austin.
But if you're looking for fast love, fast love in your eyes, it's more than enough.
Executive producer David Austin.
So fast.
Produced by Lisa Johnson. The flames give way to a sprawling listed building overlooking a neat lawn. George's home, Highgate, London 2016. Inside, someone sits at a table by a garden door, tapping keys on a vintage typewriter. Sony Music Entertainment presents, in association with Channel 4,
in 1988, George Michael became the biggest selling artist in the world. This is the story of just how fame and tragedy intervened to change his life forever.
Tony Bennett, Mary J. Blige, Naomi Campbell, James Corden.
I was massively unhappy and lonely. I remember standing there with a tear in my eye thinking, I really don't know if I'll ever do this again.
Cindy Crawford, Tracy Emin, Linda Evangelista, Jean-Paul Gaultier, Liam Gallagher.
It changed everything from that day to this. I was single, I hadn't come out. If I could have the self-awareness and the strength to walk away, I could change my life.
Elton John, Tatiana Petit, Mark Ronson.
I felt that stepping back would save me from somehow screwing up my career.
Christy Turlington, Stevie Wonder, Nile Rodgers. Freedom. George in rehearsals for MTV Unplugged, 1996.
Yeah, waiting, please.
I first became aware of George Michael's music when I was probably like, I was definitely a little girl.
I think his music was really, it's just there in your psyche. I just think it's not even taken for granted. It's just there in the ether.
There ain't no point moving on till you've got somewhere to go. And the road that I walked upon, well, it filled my buckets and emptied out my
soul. He's got a voice like an angel. There's certain songs that you could ask George just to sing and it would make people cry, just the resonance of his voice.
Some of them are about you.
It comes from someone who has felt pain, and it comes from someone who has a deep talent.
Now I know there's no way I can right those wrongs, believe me, would not.
George is in the category of many of us who have been blessed with the gift of music.
You once said there's a way back for every man, so here I am.
There's no voice like his on the radio.
Oh, don't people change? Here I am. Is it too late to try again? Here I am.
I genuinely believe that there's something very odd about people in my position, but the central belief that my musical journey would be of my own making has been the thing that's informed almost every decision I've ever made in terms of my career. I have a musical ability which was powered as a young, as a teenager, it was powered by this desperate ambition to be famous and to be loved and respected, whatever. And all I wanted at that time was success.
A young George stepping outside wearing a leather biker jacket.
I had no master plan. I didn't know if I was going to be a singer or anything, but at school I met Andrew. And we formed this ska band called The Executive, and we were terrible, basically. But Andrew and I had already developed a knack for writing these catchy little songs.
And we got together a couple of tracks. One was called Careless Whisper and one was called Wham Rap.
The 1982 Wham Rap music video. Tracy Emin.
The 80s was probably one of the most depressing, sort of demoralising times that we've ever had for young people in British history. Because of the recession, because of everything, because of mass unemployment. So I think music then was probably really, really important.
In terrible depression, you have the people that come out and say, this is terrible, this is terrible depression. This time.
The Specials.
And then you have the escapist. Things that go, let's party.
In a Top of the Pops performance from 1982, George and Andrew clap to the beat, performing a choreographed dance routine with bandmates Pepsi and Shirley.
It wasn't all sugary, he was singing about being on the dole and having kids, and, you know, there was a bit of social commentary there, and he was embracing this newfangled thing called rap, you know. Dressed like something from West Side Story. We should have known then. Then Club Tropicana taught us, don't worry, you can suntan.
He predicted global warming way before its time.
I mean, I can't get the little white shorts out of my head.
Call me good. Naomi Campbell. Call
me anything. I'll be very honest. I was a Culture Club fan, and we used to throw eggs at the Wham fans.
They were massive, weren't they, Wham, and George Michael and that? It was like, they were just fucking everywhere, weren't they?
James Corden.
Anyone of my generation, you really can't remember the first time you heard about George Michael if you grew up in the UK, because he's just part of the fabric of it.
So there is a time of Wham, which was like a lot of fun. I was going to club like Heaven, etc., and having a lot of fun, and we loved it. It was truly representing the time, you know.
Everything She Wants, 1984. Liam Gallagher.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure, like, kid, my older brother, I'm sure he had a bit of a Wham moment, you know what I mean? Somebody told me.
Ricky Gervais.
And I already felt I was too old to like them. I felt a bit ashamed that I was liking this teen band. But they were great, they had something else, they had a lot more.
George.
Wham itself was an absolute joy.
it was joyous as it sounded. They say youth is wasted on the young. My God, what a wonderful joyride for two 18-year-olds.
Edge of Heaven, 1986.
There was a humour about Wham that no one ever gave us credit for. We were so taking the piss out of ourselves half the time. How can the country be in love with these two idiots?
I knew how to make these records and how to make them jump out of the radio. And the idea that just because I was wearing ridiculous shorts and curtain rings in my ears would actually stop people from noticing that, when I look back, it's kind of, I still think it's kind of stunning.
By the end of it, I had no doubt that I could become an international solo success.
And it's as though there's always been this red line, I see it like a red line, which goes through everything, like a staircase to whatever you're about to do next. And I could feel that at the final concert. I already had one foot in my solo career.
Okay. That's enough of that.
I'm not ever going to be a fan of a boy band, right? It's not going to happen. When he went solo, the whole thing went up 10 notches.
Time can never mend the careless whispers of a good friend.
I think he was the first one that was definitely an obvious teen band to then go on to be a serious singer, songwriter, and take over the world.
In the raunchy 1987 video for I Want Your Sex, George blindfolds a blonde model.
It's still very rare for an act like that to go to America.
The 80s just spawned this handful of massive celebrities that were constantly battling the charts.
George performing Father Figure at Madison Square Garden, 1988.
If I was looking for happiness, this was the wrong road. But I don't think there's any way I could have controlled my ego enough to have stopped me exploring the possibility of being the biggest selling artist in the world. So I went with full gusto into creating a new character, you know, one that I thought would be resonant enough to stand up there next to Madonna and Jackson and Prince. And I guess I did that pretty effectively alongside what was a very, very commercial record.
Faith.
Oh, well, I guess it would be nice.
Editor of French Vogue, Emmanuel Alt.
The attitude, it was creating like a personage as we go, you know. It was very charismatic. In every video was very a strong impact.
Jean-Paul Gaultier.
It is like come on, in jeans, you know, on like tight and sexy, on like a rock image, on moving with the hips like that, you know, a little like one before, you know, a little like that, but more like sexy.
Check this out then, modern day Elvis.
I liked the spirit of Faith, because you do have to have it. I remember his baby, ow!
Baby!
Yeah, I remember that.
I didn't realise that people would look at the Faith image and go, fuck, that's cool. I was really, really overwhelmed by the size of things, I suppose. I lived in fucking sunglasses. I couldn't make eye contact with people. It was bizarre. I still suffered terribly with insecurity about my looks. It goes back to a family background where conceit of any kind was considered an absolute sin. So no one was ever praised about the way they looked.
Nile Rodgers.
Yes, I gotta have faith.
Faith was number one in Britain for 1 week, but in America, number one for 12 weeks. And then on top of that, he had four number one singles a number two single, and a number five single. In 1988, he was the biggest pop star in the world.
Mary J. Blige.
All I remember is Faith being played 50 times a day on MTV. You had to be in heavy rotation on whatever pop station you were on. Duran Duran, David Bowie, Eurythmics was played on MTV, like constantly, played on all the video stations. You really didn't hear any of those artists, but you heard George Michael on some of the urban stations, right after Luther Vandross. His music broke through to everybody.
In America, radio play for me was substantial on a lot of R&B stations.
He uniquely achieved recognition on the R&B soul charts that very few white performers ever got. He obviously had studied American soul music and felt a connection and a kindred spirit. We were introduced to each other. So we're going back now to about 86, maybe, and it was his thought that he wanted to do a duet with one of my artists.
George Michael and Aretha Franklin, I Knew You Were Waiting For Me.
Great that I had my own voice and that I'd worked with Aretha Franklin and everything had gone so well. From an artistic point of view, it just got better and better.
George Michael's voice to me was always very soulful, and it was very warm and sultry and urgent. He had soul, period.
Soul is an expression of the soul, of the heart.
It was good to be number one in the black charts. It was an amazing thing to see, obviously.
England has a great love affair with American black music and R&B and a great tradition of our own interpretation of soul music and that thing, but he's kind of up there at the pinnacle of it. But remember this, every other kiss that you ever gave.
Making that album, I'm sure I was incredibly proud of it, but I don't think I ever imagined it would be bigger than Wham.
I imagine that the pressure on someone like Jordan must have been insane, because he was doing stuff that was just so phenomenal. After you have that kind of success, like, what do you go home at night and go, now what do I do?
I do remember it being shocking to me that I could become more successful than I had been with Wham. I suppose the whole exercise was an effort to raise my profile, to kind of define what my solo image was going to be. But I really had no idea how effective it was going to be, especially in America. And I had no idea what it was like to be that big in America.
George is really, really private. And I think when he was young, with all that fame, I just think it came too fast and it wasn't actually what he was expecting.
I was probably most out of control in any kind of sense like that during the whole Faith thing. Being caught in the eye of this storm is catastrophic. It's just 24/7, full-time, in your face. I mean, the windburn is terrible.
I can't really explain how overwhelming that kind of hysteria can be if there's only one person to absorb it. When I was with Andrew, it was so easy to keep one foot in my old life, the life that I'd known with him before we'd been famous. It was so easy to keep each other grounded and to take the piss out of each other and be able to look at each other and talk about the madness that was going on around us. But when you can't do that, suddenly it is scary. I don't know many 24-year-olds who would not have, at least subconsciously, found that frightening enough to self-destruct. Now,
the problem is the record came out everywhere in the world pretty much at the same time. So everybody wanted a piece of George to help promote the album. Enormous pressure. Huge, huge pressure.
10 months of that was enough to really push me to the edge.
I was terribly lonely. Me and my red line were very lonely. And the only good part of my day was playing live.
When I sang Careless Whisper, I can't remember which was the last gig on the American tour, which would have been the end of the whole tour. I think it was Pensacola. But when I sang Careless Whisper that night, I remember standing there with a tear in my eye thinking, I really don't know if I'll ever do this again.
The Pensacola performance, October 1988. Looks down, gripping his mic stand. Freedom. A vinyl record spinning under a needle.
I was intelligent enough to know I should not be trying to catch up with Michael Jackson or Madonna or whatever, which was absolutely what I was intent on doing. I felt that tired and exhausted at being the centre of that much attention. I suppose the way my lack of mental balance showed itself was that I actually really began to hide away when I got home. And I did almost nothing for a year but try and re-establish some idea of a real life.
Music was my very controlling lover. I had millions of lovers that I never saw other than in the sense of live work. But I still deserved one, just one of them for me. And I knew that the only way I was going to find that one person, that lover, was to jump off of the merry-go-round just for long enough to catch my breath and letting my heart rule my head rather than, you know, the red line. The red line that goes up, 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 up.
Sometimes you feel like he's got like a layer or two of skin missing. Like he bruises easier, and because of that, he can write these amazing songs.
I never wanted to be someone else. I wanted to be a star, and I wanted people to love me and recognize me in the street. As a child, that was what I wanted, but I never really wanted to be someone else. I believe I am a writer much more than I am anything else, and I want to leave songs. I believe I can leave songs that will mean something to other generations.
The American Music Awards.
This award is for favorite soul and R&B album.
And the winner is George Michael.
George takes to the stage to accept the award for favorite soul R&B album.
I've been a lover of soul music since I was a kid. And I'd just like to thank everybody who's helped me this year. I'd like to thank Black Radio. I'd like to thank everyone in CBS Records, in the R&B department. And I'd like to thank everyone who voted for me. I can't believe it. Thank you very much.
I won these two awards that were traditionally received by black artists. And I think there was a perception that it had gone too far.
The black male artist works very hard to get his due. If Bobby Brown had a cross-the-board play, and he could compete in the same category as George Michael competes in, that would be a whole nother thing.
This was the same point in time that Public Enemy arrived, Spike Lee arrived.
Playback!
Public Enemies, Fight the Power.
Flav, I saw you on the American Music Awards. What's George Michael doing there? How'd he win all the awards? How'd he win R&B category?
Suddenly, crossover was not hit. And I see their point. I totally saw their point at the time. I just felt it was sad, you know, that white and black people recording together suddenly was kind of dancing with the enemy.
You mean George is white? Are you serious? Oh, my God. And he is blind, right?
I think it had a huge effect on George because he'd won in this category. He'd achieved something that was beyond his wildest dreams, only to have the carpet pulled from under his feet.
I don't think there's any attempt to kind of steal black heritage in what I'm doing. All I think that's happening is I'm trying to make good music.
Music is not based on the color of one's skin or, you know, it says, well, this is soul music or this is pop or this is... To me, those things are like, it's kind of old, you know what I mean?
Cutting the vinyl reissue of Listening Without Prejudice.
I suddenly couldn't get anywhere near radio, black radio. And that was the reason, really, Listen Without Prejudice was called Listen Without Prejudice. It was me saying, here's an album that has bits of gospel, you know, bits of R&B, some very white stuff. And it was just trying to say, let me be both of these things without having to be one or the other.
I don't know if I bought it, stole it, or it just sort of like just got delivered. You know what I mean? Sometimes you get albums like that, don't you know what I mean? That just, they're that great, they just end up in your house.
What can I say about the sound of it? It's very ethereal. It has a mystery about it. George, on this album, got everything that he had inside his gut onto vinyl or CD or cassette. And thank God he did.
Well, let's have a party, pop pickers.
Liam plays the record.
In fucking one.
This song now, it's just got such a big opening and message, actually, I think.
That opening, it reminds me of John Lennon. Like, of one of John's solo albums. These are the days of the open hand.
Praying for Time, 1990. Look around now,
these are the days of the bears and the choosers. When I listen to George Michael's songs, I think not only he's tapped into his dark side of whatever's going on in his life, but he's tapped into the truth about who he is and what he is and what life is, and he wasn't afraid to share that with us. The rich declare themselves poor, and most of us
are not sure if we have too much. James Corden mouths the lyrics. Mark Ronson.
Not only really just his writing, but it's the vocal performance, you know, and it's always just like, it just always feels so honest. You just believe kind of every word that he sings, and even the ad-libs, even him throwing out a line is like better than most people's verses.
When I hear that, it is right up there, you know what I mean? And then you get into the lyrics. The one that jumps out is the rich declare themselves poor. I like it because it's got a bit of a dig, you know what I mean? It's like, I mean, that's the way I take it anyway. It's like, you bunch of fucking cunts, you know what I mean? Always fucking playing the poverty card. But I like that, so it's got a bit of a Lennon vibe. He likes to dig people out. There was no one before the Beatles that did them kind of songs. It's a classic, it's up there. I'd say it could have been cut from the same cloth as Imagine, you know what I mean?
James Corden stops the record.
Oh, it's a bit much, isn't it? I didn't expect to be as moved as I am. Let me tell you a secret.
Put it in your heart. Heal the Pain, from Listen Without Prejudice.
It was my time to discover the Beatles. And at the time, I was big into Abbey Road and Revolver and, you know. And it's the people that you're trying to emulate sometimes that can bring you up. I made one record to show how much I love Lennon. I made another record to show how much I love McCartney. I didn't dream that McCartney would ever sing it. And actually, when he sings it, it sounds like a Paul McCartney record.
And next week, we're going to do some vocals, yeah? Because you're in for
it. It's the most surreal moment of my career, I think, to have Paul McCartney singing something that I wrote as a tribute to Paul McCartney. I don't think I would have had the nerve to ask him when I wrote it.
Sounded like a fucking group. Cool.
Won't you show me your heart now? I'll be good to you. I can make this thing true. And get to your heart somehow.
Yeah. Go on, love.
Yeah! Live 8 concert.
Okay. You know, the man forgot to introduce me. I heard the beginning of Baby, You Can Drive My Car start. There's this bit of film of me going,
nobody fucking told me to go on.
So that's what I did. I just ran on just before I was supposed to sing the chorus.
He runs on.
Baby, you can drive my car.
Mary J. Blige.
I haven't done this in a long time.
She plays George's Stevie Wonder cover, They Won't Go When I Go. Then Stevie and Elton John listen to the same song on their own record players.
See how piano-based the album is?
No more lying friends, wanting tragic ends, though they do pretend they won't go when I go.
I mean, it sounds like Stevie.
Mary.
Love this song.
All those bleeding
I hear so much exhaustion. Like, not exhaustion in him as an artist, but exhaustion in him, you know, as a human in this world that we live in. I hear a fight. Sometimes, you know, but you definitely hear the pure talent. I hear hope.
Brilliant.
They Won't Go When I Go, for sure. Like, that was probably my introduction even to Stevie Wonder.
The version they did of They Won't Go When I Go, it brings back a lot of memories because it's a thought that at the end of the day, we come alone in this world and we will die alone. And it's what we do in between that's going to determine how and what we'll be remembered as and what we can think about in spirit. So it was great to hear him sing the song.
Stevie harmonizes with an electric harp. Nile Rodgers.
I'm actually crying. So, you know, it takes a massive amount of bravery for George to do a song like that. When you go into an area that you know is sort of like sacred ground. You're going to a place because your heart tells you to go there. You have a love of something and you wanna live in that world.
Reason for me doing so many Stevie Wonder covers, I've done in over various sets, I've done like 4 or 5 Stevie Wonder covers and apart from the fact that I consider him to be an incredible writer, his voice, the key that he was writing for at that time is perfectly suited to my voice.
Stevie and George performing together in 1997.
'Cause where it is, it
George reminds me of me as a little kid, you know, my passion for music. He and I doing Living for the City, I remember that. It was a lot of fun. Chemistry is something that you can't fake. It's about how you relate to each other and how it connects.
As the crowd applauds, George throws his arms around Stevie. A koi fish swimming in a pond in the grounds of his Highgate home, the lengths of black and white film covered with shadowy images of George.
I'm aware of the need for a persona, and my actual persona I'm not really prepared to give. I'm a real homebody. I'd much rather be taking my dog for a walk, or, you know, be with friends.
George and his dogs.
I feel like I don't belong out there being this professional person going around selling his wares.
He had a much harder journey than me in a way, because if you get fame and accolades and wealth beyond your wildest dreams as a teenager, it usually goes wrong. But he obviously had a wiser head on his shoulders than most.
Like, I think a lot of young musicians now are kind of, you know, what's the word? Manufactured. And I think for him, he didn't ever want to be like that. And part of his reactionary way was to break away from all of that.
I was still struggling with the idea of having that much attention. And I think I recoiled from that. And I felt that stepping back would save me from somehow screwing up my career. I see kind of hard sell promotion as prostituting myself. I can't help it. Even if it's a complete fallacy, that's how I see it. I'm of that generation.
He felt he needed to withdraw from the merry-go-round that is promoting and albums, and explained in a very articulate way that he just felt he had to withdraw from that for the moment for his own sanity, that we would probably get more albums out of him if we just allowed him to back off. That was quite a bombshell, I suppose, for us to have to deal with.
The fact that he didn't do any promotion of it, it begs, you know, it's quite astonishing.
Mark Ronson turns on the next record, then Stevie Wonder taps his fingers to the beat. Elton John.
What's coming up now is one of the great intros. And I was not me on piano either, which is, I always hated him for that.
In the Freedom 90 video, male model John Pearson and supermodel Linda Evangelista mouth the lyrics. Listening to the song, Stevie Wonder taps his electric harp.
Freedom 90 is kind of like this funk groove masterpiece that just comes in on like track two. You're striving to make something every time you go in the studio half as good as a record like that. It's the Mona Lisa.
Jean-Paul Gaultier.
Big change man is not there. He doesn't appear. Beautiful girls are there. The top model.
If you're going to say to your record company, look, I'm not going to be in this video, I'd say that's a fairly good consolation prize, really. Five absolutely gorgeous supermodels that people still want to look at today.
It changed the whole face of how videos were done. The video said everything. It was genius, and it was a revolutionary thing.
George had raised the bar to a whole new level.
That was like a big statement. It was really well done. It could have been a disaster.
It was a specific group of women that George wanted and that had just been on the cover of British Vogue that was shot by Peter Lindbergh. It was like, he wants you five and it has to be all of you five.
Now in fashion, there is no supermodels like this. This is gone. It was like the magic moment of modeling.
I suppose that's the lasting memory of that whole video shoot was the cost of the girls and the fees they were charging on a daily basis. That was pretty groundbreaking.
George pitched it to me in LA, and his exact words were, "You're the leader of the gang, and unless you say yes, the rest of the girls won't."
His people talk to my people. Yeah, you know how it went back then.
It was like, what was Christy doing it?
Christy Turlington nods her head to the music.
My scene where I'm sort of crawling on the ground and you just see my eyes, and people think, like, oh, that's so, like, sexy and mysterious, is just really, I didn't know the words.
I prepared in the trailer with George. He showed me how to hit the notes, and it's hard to lip sync.
David Fincher was directing it. And even though the shot ended up looking like a steamy bath scene, there was no water in the tub. I was freezing cold. I was covered in glycerin to make my skin shiny. And I kind of thought, I hope Fincher knows what he's doing.
I remember David and George working closely together. He was, you know, right there looking through the lens at times.
Everything suited each girl. So I think it was just strong, and we were all so different.
It's such a fun song. And when you listen to the words and kind of the statement, it has much more meaning. And I feel like that whole time for George Michael was about him saying, enough. Like, you guys tried to prepackage me and sell me in a way that wasn't authentic.
In present day, Christy Turlington, Tatiana Petit, Linda Evangelista, Naomi Campbell, and Cindy Crawford listen to the record. Jean-Paul Gaultier.
You can see the biker jacket, which is burning like with fire. So it's like symbolic.
I got the impression he was saying, like, that chapter's closed and I'm done being a public figure pop star.
The burning of the jacket, the exploding guitar, the exploding jukebox was me just saying, I'm sick of this. I really can't cope with it.
Andy Stevens, MD of Epic UK, 93 to 95.
Not only were we not going to get him appearing in promotional videos, but we weren't going to get his image on the album sleeve. We weren't going to get his name on the album sleeve. Would I have chosen an album sleeve that wasn't a beat shot taken from 1940 or whenever it was? Yeah. Would I have liked his name on the album? Yeah, of course I would.
A lot of people are just pimping themselves out 24/7, you know what I mean? And there's a mystique about George Michael.
But today, photos of George with Christy and Linda.
Now I'm gonna get me some happy.
Making records is fun, and then you have to talk about it, which is not fun. Yeah, I thought it was bonkers. But then it all makes sense, doesn't it?
When I spoke to the Los Angeles Times about stepping back from promotion, Frank Sinatra wrote me an open letter that just said, you know, get over it. Be glad that God gave you a gift and get out there and use it. I don't think he wrote the letter. I actually believed that was the work of a publicist, not the work of a genius.
What a wonderful letter. Here, probably the greatest male singer of all time is saying, embrace your talent, enjoy the success, don't be threatened by it.
Now, even though he's the greatest singer that ever walked the planet, as far as I'm concerned, I wasn't taking any advice from Frank Sinatra.
You can't put a gun to any creative person's head and say, create, write, promote, market, whatever. You just have to go with it. That's what we had to do.
By now, even though I thought I'd delivered them what I felt was a great album and a visual feast in the form of Freedom 90, Sony America was not promoting Listen Without Prejudice. In the meantime, I did the one thing I was prepared to do. Live work.
Maracanã Stadium, Rio de Janeiro, 1991. George performing Killer, Papa Was a Rolling Stone at Rock in Rio.
The basis for me going to do Rock in Rio was I wanted to see Brazil. Front of this 160,000 people, there was this guy over on the right-hand side of the stage that just fixed me with this look, and it was so cute. I was so distracted by him that I stayed away from that end of the stage for a while. Because otherwise I thought I was going to get really distracted and forget the words or something, you know? The moment I looked at him, I got the feeling that told me I was going to know him very well and that he was going to be a part of my life.
A home movie.
Anselmo was the first time I think I really loved someone selflessly. It was kind of immediate. Everybody, with the exception of my family, was introduced to him very, very quickly because I felt immediately that everything had changed.
All our friends knew, of course. I remember seeing him and just thinking how, just feeling so happy for him. The two of them met and it changed George's life.
George Michael and Astrugi Gilberto, Desafinado. In holiday movies, Anselmo stands arm in arm with a female friend. Then George grins at the camera, sitting behind the wheel of a convertible. A beaming Anselmo does some sit-ups. Then George waves his arms, taking a dip in a circular jacuzzi. George on VH1's Behind the Music, 1997.
It's very hard to be proud of your own sexuality when it hasn't brought you any joy. Once it is associated with joy and love, it's easy to be proud of who you are.
In 2005...
It's the first time you actually believe somebody loves you. That's a wonderful moment in your life, and it was a wonderful 6 months.
What a poser.
He was just very full of energy, very loving.
I was happier than I'd ever been in my entire life.
He didn't care who saw him with Anselmo. He'd found something. He'd found what he was looking for, you know.
By the time I met Anselmo, I had made the decision to jump off the merry-go-round. And I was already in the early stages of my confrontation with Sony.
Recording an album and then saying, I'm not going to promote it, or I'm not going to market it, I'm not going to participate, that's a serious detriment to an album.
I think we had some personality issues between people in the UK and people in the American company.
Why wasn't this Faith Part 2? We want all those nice pop songs. What do you mean he's not going to promote you? He's not going to have his image on it?
It's like saying I'll do a movie, but I won't do one premiere. I won't do any interviews for the movie. You know, you say, oh, my God.
The moment someone says to a musician or to an artist, make more of them or do more of that, it kills you. And I think probably for someone like George, especially at certain times in his career, he must have felt quite trapped.
In England, they made an effort. And Listen Without Prejudice outsold Faith. And in lots of places, it outsold Faith because I think it was actually a better album. But it wasn't about that. It was about the total and utter lack of respect, that the minute somebody doesn't see themselves as a commodity, that they actually have the audacity to think, my God, I am actually creating something and I must keep myself sane in order to do that. The minute somebody does that, they're over.
We tried very, very hard to get the American executives to come over and listen to why George felt the way that he did from George, because there was no one better to put that forward than George Michael telling them, as he had told us, the reasons, how he really felt deep down, but they wouldn't come.
There were executives that came to London in 1989, and we played them the record. I explained to them that faith had taken me to the edge of madness, that I wanted to be a long-term player in this business. Now, any logical CEO, I think, would have thought, okay, he's gonna do this, he'll get it out of his system, and he'll get back on board.
George is very stubborn. He's incredibly one of the most stubborn people I've ever met. But he was right to be stubborn on this occasion, and I'm sure the record company recoiled in horror.
It was very much a clash of cultures, really. In America, there was definitely a door that shut.
George with Elton John.
I managed to have a couple of really big hit records in the meantime. There was the track with Elton, and of course the Red Hot and Dance album came out.
Too Funky. In the video, Linda Evangelista sashays down a catwalk.
It was very difficult to make that video. It all fell apart, not for any of George's reasons. It just fell apart, and he saved it.
Linda, bless her heart, came back again. We got a bit drunk. I won't say any more about that.
It's your stupid, stupid.
Oh. This would look great on me.
I think George
would have. So I realised at that point that if a hit record was not going to reinstate any kind of relationship with Sony, then nothing was.
I don't want to pick a fight. I just wanted to work with people who wanted to work with me and who would have some respect for the fact that I was growing up.
It was deeply, deeply troubling times. Because you could see this. It's like trying to watch a train wreck in slow motion. There's nothing you could do to stop it.
A Los Angeles street flanked by towering palm trees.
Anselmo and I were in LA when he was advised to go for his test. He hadn't been tested for a while, and he was absolutely healthy-looking, more than healthy-looking when I first met him. Within a month or two of meeting him, he had a flu that he couldn't get rid of, and some red marks that came up on his chest. And I remember the kind of terror of me understanding that this was possibly the beginning of, you know, an illness. I remember him leaving the house, and to this day, I remember looking at the sky and saying, "Don't you dare do this to me." I mean, I was 27, going on 28, but at that point in time, you think like that's a lifetime to have waited to be loved. And Selma had the test in Brazil. I went home to my family for Christmas and sat at the Christmas table, not knowing whether my partner, the people sitting around the table did not know about, not knowing whether this man I was in love with was terminally ill, and therefore not knowing whether I potentially was terminally ill. That Christmas was probably the darkest, most frightening time in my life. I remember my publicist calling me to tell me that Freddie Mercury had died, and he died of HIV, obviously. And I remember I was crying, and she just thought, I mean, bless him, I was really sad that Freddie had passed away, but of course I was crying about something else entirely, which was the fact that both my partner and possibly myself were HIV.
It was an incredibly difficult period for George because it was something that he had to hold close to his chest.
I was just absolutely devastated to find out that he had a terminal illness. I was just devastated.
Queen, rehearsing with George Michael, 1992.
even by the time Freddie's tribute had been put together, I was still sworn to secrecy.
At the tribute concert,
I'm very proud of that performance, but Anselmo was in the crowd. And I went out there knowing that I had to honour Freddie Mercury and I had to pray for Anselmo. I just wanted to die inside. So it was so much to me, all in that one performance.
Smiles as George twirls in front of him.
I was so overwhelmed by the sadness of singing the songs of this man that I'd absolutely worshipped as a child, who had passed away in the same manner that my first live-in partner was going to experience. It was just overwhelming for me.
A photo of George. Then Anselmo lying on a beach.
It's not an accident that the performance probably most well known in my career was sung to my lover who was dying. He was the reason that I had the strength to go to battle with Sony. I saw it as, if I'm going to do nothing but love this man and care for this man, if I could do nothing beneficial as a musician, because I cannot even think of a note, maybe I have a chance to do something truly special and change the standard record contract forever.
I didn't think that it would end up in court at the time, because I really thought that sanity would prevail. Well, I was wrong. It didn't.
Our relationship broke down because they said, no, you are this kind of artist. This is the kind of artist that we sell. This is the kind of artist we know how to sell. And if you don't want to sell yourself that way and you want to go off on this journey and find this other audience, we're not going to support you.
The relationship had completely disintegrated. George flew out to New York with his publisher, and basically it was at that meeting that George told the head people at Sony that he'd wanted out of the deal, wanted a divorce.
What he was basically saying is, how can I stay with a company who won't support me in any way when I feel so strongly? We issued a writ 3 days later.
Clouds drifting across a blue sky.
I will never know if Sony and I would have ended up in court had Anselmo not become ill. I was absolutely terrified of losing him and the prospect of watching him die of AIDS.
Birds over the ocean.
I was in LA and the phone rang and I was told that Anselmo's best friend in Brazil was on the phone. And then it all goes blurry for a long time.
In a home movie, Anselmo smiles, then steps into shadow. Anselmo Felipa, 1958-1993. Highgate Village, London, 2016.
He still, 23 years later, brings a tear to my eye. He was my saviour. It's still very hard for me to explain how finding a companion at that stage in my life changed me. And such a beautiful companion, such an amazing person. I think, to some degree, the Sony court case was a perfectly good place to put my anger. I used to go and run on the treadmill every day and play squash and do everything I could to get rid of all this anger and fear. But the best place for it was court number one, really.
George arriving at court.
There was the part of my personality that could say, OK, fuck this. This can't all be bad. I've got to do something good with this time in my life and change the path of artists' lives.
One of Britain's most successful pop singers, George Michael, is today asking a high court judge to declare his recording contract null and void. He says the contract with Sony Music is too restrictive and that the company takes too much of the profits.
George Michael's counsel told the court that this case is not about money. Mark Cran, QC, argues that his client's contract is in restraint of trade. He stressed what he called its unreasonable length, perhaps 12 to 15 years, and he says it's drafted in Sony's favour. For the music industry, this case could mean a dramatic shift in power towards major artists.
What is it going to mean for the record industry?
This was a worldwide major artist saying to a record company that the basic contract which record companies used was invalid.
If you really fall out with the people who control your professional life, you have a right to walk away. I think that is the right of every individual. And the music industry takes away that right from every artist it signs.
George is very, very brave. He's not afraid of anybody. And he thought he was being wronged, and he went out and fought his own corner.
What we couldn't do was stand up and say, yeah, you're right. These contracts are slavery, and they shouldn't be allowed. Your Honour, we weren't going to do that.
You'd have artist after artist queuing up to take their record company to court.
I can't think of one artist that supported me. I know of a lot of artists who sat back and waited for the result, but that's a different thing.
Artists like George Michael come along, if you're lucky, once in a lifetime. My feelings as the court case ran on were that we'd lost him. How could you ever patch that up?
I'd never let on to George of the problems until after he'd been in the witness box. And I said, it's not going well. And, you know, you shouldn't raise your hopes at this stage.
BBC News.
The pop star George Michael loses his High Court battle to break away from his record company Sony. In dismissing the claim, the judge, Mr. Justice Parker, ruled that the contract was both reasonable and fair. The 30-year-old singer had argued that the agreement was stifling his artistic development, and he'd threatened never to record for Sony again if he lost. George Michael says he'll appeal against the judgment, which he said condemned him to professional slavery.
At a press conference, George reads a written statement.
Having received this judgment, I would like to reiterate the reasons why I embarked upon these proceedings. I have no right to resign. In fact, there is no such thing as resignation for an artist in the music industry. Effectively, you sign a piece of paper at the beginning of your career, and you are expected to live with that decision, good or bad,
for the rest of your professional life. I shall obviously take full advice from my lawyers, but the initial view is that we have very strong grounds for appeal, and we hope to have the appeal heard as quickly as possible. Thank you very much for your time and for all the support that I've received since this action began. Thank you. After the court case was finished and I'd lost, and not just lost, I lost completely. I mean, I lost on everything, every count. They then called up and, you know, kind of said, well, can't we patch things up kind of thing? But I knew in reality that was like a formality, they had to do that. But ultimately, the whole thing was a complete waste of time. And I regret it to this day.
Looking back on it now, 25 years on, my first thought is, I just think it's sad.
When you win a court case, you're normally out there high-fiving and putting the drinks in. But I don't think anyone felt, not in my team anyway, any sense of euphoria.
Certainly there were no winners. I mean, we won the court case, but we didn't win anything.
You've actually lost because you've lost the support of that artist.
George, he said in passing, David Frost wants to do an interview with me. And I said, you've got to do it. They know you're a man of principle. Now, you've got to be a man of principle who's totally obsessed.
Well, what happens now is that we go to appeal. I can't see any other way around it. I mean, of course, there is the ultimate option of an appeal at the House of Lords, which would take forever.
Oh, it was all bluff. I mean, they intended to take it to the Court of Appeal in the UK, never to the House of Lords, never to the European Court of Justice.
They can only lose by going to appeal.
Everybody was watching, including David Geffen.
No one was going to let a talent like that flounder out there for very long.
So David Geffen contacts Sony and said to them, listen, guys, he's never, ever going to make another piece of music for you, ever. You might as well let him go.
Manhattan rooftops.
I flew to New York, had a very quick meeting there where basically, you know, we agreed that the contract would be sold. I was like in seventh heaven.
Sony said, we want this transfer fee, and they would have bought you a top-class footballer. In fact, he most probably even bought you Lionel Messi in those days.
In the end, he did whatever he did with David Geffen and Virgin and basically bought himself out of the contract. Was it a good decision in the hindsight of history? I'm not sure.
George unquestionably lost the battle but won the war because he got a freedom that he craved for, because he felt he had to get away.
Prince on stage.
Peace to George Michael.
George's Highgate Home.
I think the whole experience of losing Anselmo, the period of grief, roughly 2 years that I didn't write a note of music, and then the absolute knowledge that the next album I was going to write would be about grief and recovery. Older is my greatest moment.
Jesus to a Child, 1996.
I sat at a keyboard, played a very simple string part. Stream of consciousness, rubbish, comes out my head. Just rubbish. And then I sang Like Jesus to a Child. And I thought, oh my God, that's him. That's him and me. Like Jesus to a Child. When you find love, when you
know that it exists. And I was so excited that I'd finally been able to put my feelings about Anselmo into words. And within a week of writing it, I was singing it in front of the Brandenburg Gate, paying my first kind of public tribute to him there.
Where I've been loved. his performance at the MTV Europe Music Awards, November 1994. In the Jesus to a Child video, a figure dressed in black stands alone at the end of a pier. Oh, the love I still miss
was Jesus to a child. I just celebrate people who are able to use their joys and their pains to really help people to heal.
I think I wrote the best, most healing piece of music. It was all systems go from that point on. In the absence of security, I
made my way into the night. In the video for Fast Love, George sits in a rotating chair with speakers embedded in its back.
For anyone who had a clue about any kind of symbolism, I was coming out. And you know, Fast Love makes me laugh because it's all about cruising and covering my pain, blunting out that pain with fast love. Simple as that. I do believe that we are practicing the same religion. There's not one track on that album that is not about Anselmo, about the risk of AIDS, which was spinning the wheel. I believe I was destined to feel that particular pain so that I could do the ultimate with my music in terms of healing. And the number of people who come up to me and say, oh, you don't know how much you helped me with Older when I lost this person or when I lost that person.
And the winner of the Best Male Solo Artist is George Michael.
The Brit Awards.
Now, unfortunately, George cannot be here tonight, but I have a message from him, and I've got to read it out. And it says, to everybody here and everybody watching at home, I would like to apologize for not attending tonight's awards show. I would genuinely have loved to have been there to say a huge thank you.
I had about 6 month period where things were okay and I was recording Older. Then I found out that my mother had cancer.
A photo of George's mother smiling playfully.
I was so spiritually crushed after Mum died. So crushed and so felt so bloody picked on by the gods, you know. For all of my adult life, she was phenomenal, absolutely phenomenal. A terrible, horrible loss. From the day that I found out about my partner to the day that I could say I actually felt that I was on the mend from my mother, it was just constant fear. It was either fear of death or fear of the next bereavement, you know. And I just took it very, very badly indeed. I'd never felt that kind of depression. It was something different to grief. It was on top of grief because I was grieving for my mother still. But it was something else. It was, I felt like a sportsman that had had a terrible injury in the middle of an incredibly successful career. I'm so much more aware of how intrinsic to my entire being it is to be able to create music. Having lost it for 3 or 4 years of my life, I really did. I lost the music at the center of me, which was like losing God for me. It really was. It was the darkest time. But even when I've lost control, even when I've really hit rock bottom, I believe that the red line is still there.
There's a part of George which is really private. His inner soul is quite private. There's a space for him, and I think that's why, you know, his writing, his music, his performing, all of that is this big external thing, but all of that comes from some really private internal place. I think if George wasn't like a superstar musician, he'd be an accountant that writes poetry every night. Do you know what I mean?
At the EMAs.
I'd just like to say very genuinely, I'm really touched by this. The first half of the 90s was pretty crap for me, and 1996 has kind of made it all worthwhile. Thank you very much.
Stevie Wonder.
It always feels better when you're able to, you know, to be yourself, to just be you. And being you means, you know, not being afraid or ashamed of sharing the gift that you've been given.
One, two, three, dance. Stop. People counting the money until your soul turns green.
George is authentic, and there aren't that many authentic artists around.
He's real. He's not mass-produced. He isn't owned. He isn't bossed around by anybody. He's never been bossed around by record companies. He's done exactly what he's wanted to do, you know. And everyone has this, had this go at him, about him, because he didn't come out when he was 18. Loads of people didn't come out when they're 18, especially when they just got signed up to some fucking giant record label. But boy, did he come out later in a big way.
Yes, I've been back.
The video for Outside.
When he came out, I wanted to go, George, you don't need, we know. Don't make a song and dance about it. And he did a song about it, didn't he? He did a whole song and dance about it. He's fearless. He disarms the press, because they think they've got him. They say, oh, you did this. And he goes, yep. And then when they went, your guy, he went, yeah. Sorry, I didn't call you. You know what I mean? He didn't call everyone. Listen.
I think people genuinely adore George, not just the music, but they feel for him and his struggle.
He's a villain. George Michael is probably my favourite singing convict. Bless him. He did his time.
We're all imperfect, and we've all made mistakes. George has made his mistakes sometimes publicly, but people are willing to forget, because underneath, I know for a fact George is one of the most kindest, most generous people I've ever met in my life.
James Corden.
His music feels like feelings or moments in your life that are personal to you. Someone saying the very same thing that you felt. It feels like he just puts his arm around you and says, you're not on your own. It's just such a journey. He's just taken us on a journey with him.
Baby, I'm your man. I love it, you know.
In a sketch for BBC Comic Relief 2011, George and James Corden sing in a van, wearing matching tracksuits.
You bet, if you're gonna do it, do it right.
Without that sketch, I don't think I'd have a successful show in America, because there was something so joyful about it. There was something so brilliant about being with him that made us go, oh, I wonder if we could do that with other artists.
In Extras, George played George Michael on Hampstead Heath, looking for fun.
I've only got 20 minutes, actually. I'm on my lunch break.
He just nailed it. He gave us that sort of decadent, almost bored rock star.
Lunch break? Yeah, I'm doing community service. Are you still doing that? Oh, not that one. No, I'm doing another one now. I'm picking up litter now. All right. What'd you do wrong this time? Fly tipping, believe it or not.
It was great. It was really, really great. I was really, really knocked out on how good an actor he was, and such a sport.
Well, I better get going, because, you know, I'm going to have to get back to work soon. So.
Come on then, you. I'll give you a quickie.
Oi, I'm not that desperate, matey.
Cheeky bastard.
I'll be your sexual queen.
I think he's challenged the stereotype of the gay man as well.
and what was acceptable. Because, you know, even when people were out in like the 60s and 70s, they were a safe, sexless, gay man. Whereas George went, I've got a cock. that frightened some people. Yeah. Literally, I imagine.
That's one thing about George, he's really sexy. You know, really sexy. And living with that, good looking, sexy, talented, you know, it's tough out there.
It's very hairy, isn't it? Tony, 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 I know that you're homie, but there's something about that pushing
brain. There's so many different facets to George. And you can see him growing as an artist and moving away from the original stuff into more beautiful kind of Edith Piaf, Frank Sinatra territory. But it's George.
Tony Bennett.
I just loved him. He was very friendly. We got along great. He just walked in very prepared, and he was so spontaneous. We did it in one take. I couldn't believe how equipped he was. I may not see. And I remember saying, boy, this guy is gonna be around a long time. Forever.
I really am not in the business of selling myself anymore. When I do it, I want to do it properly. She takes the back
road and the lane. You Have Been Loved, Symphonica Tour 2002. In all this
time. When he does up tempo, it's full of joy, and when he does sorrow, which is the true mark of a great singer, you can hear the pain and everything. He's a brilliant singer of lyrics. It's an extraordinary talent to have. Just to give him life, that man, she loved that man
for all his life. I absolutely, definitely know that George Michael fits into the category of a great artist, a great performer.
George Michael and Mary J. Blige as.
Now I know deep in my you can hear pain, you can hear joy, you can hear everything in George Michael. And I'll be loving you. Loving you
until the rainbow burns the stars. Stevie Wonder.
Mary J. Blige and George Michael doing as, which was amazing. The marriage of the two of them was just a magical experience of that song. And I was in awe when I heard it.
Clive Davis.
I know him as an extremely gifted artist, and I embrace the records that he made with Aretha and Whitney, probably my two greatest vocalists.
George Michael and Whitney Houston, If I Told You That.
You want to watch him, you're interested in him, you want to listen to him, you want to know what he's got to say.
The impact that he's had, you have to see when you go to his concerts. You have to really see it. It is phenomenal.
So would you like one more song?
The word I think I'm hearing the most is... Freedom!
Mark Ronson.
When you play somebody a record like Freedom, that music is gonna continue to mean something to people, like, as long as it's heard. And that's why you get to have a three-decade career.
Footage of George singing Freedom to a packed stadium in the 1990s, then again in the 2000s. George prompts the crowd to raise their hands. Then the word freedom rotates in bright light around the O2 during the closing ceremony of the London 2012 Olympic Games. You got to give what you take, what you In the Freedom 90 video, Linda Evangelista hides in the neck of her sweater before dissolving into giggles. Then Naomi Campbell mouths the lyrics as the song fades out. Then, under a spotlight, a smiling George waves to his audience. A TV interview.
What would you be hopeful for as a way to be remembered?
I mean, what would I like written on my...
Well, let's not go that far.
Okay.
But, I mean, what would you hope the legacy that's attached to your name is?
Great songwriter. You know, and... I think two things. One, you know, a great singer-songwriter from a period of time which I don't think we'll be seeing again. You know, I don't think youth culture will produce people like myself and Madonna and Prince. I don't think it's going to do that anymore. I think it's too fragmented now. So I'd like to be remembered as one of those last kind of big stars, in the sense that there was a certain glamour to it. But really, it's just the songs, and I hope that people think of me as someone who had some kind of integrity, and I hope I'm remembered for that in a way. Very unlikely. I think it's all been a waste of time. Waste of effort. I'd
say love. George Michael and Chris Martin, A Different Corner, 2017. Would keep us from pain had I been there. Had I been there. I would promise you all of my life, but to lose you would cut like a knife, so I don't dare. No, I don't dare. All of these years, you are the only one to stop my tears. And I'm so scared, I'm so
If I could, I would, I swear.
George Michael, 1963 to 2016.